revolution in the streets for peace. Together as one. Throw out the laundry list and start anew. Make love and peace the number one thing to do. I know it ain't easy. You gotta change your plans. But future generations will clap their hands. It's time to stand up on your feet and join the revolution in the streets for peace.
John Michael's son. And this is Chris. The show is Peace and Justice. And just a second here. Not coming through my own headphones. Just one second. I'm going to put the music back on just for a second. Hang on. Hi. So anyway, this is Chris. The show is Peace and Justice, and we're on every Friday with rotating hosts. Today I have amazing guests. My guest in the on the phone is Danica Katovich, and she is a graduate from DePaul University, summa cum laude, with a bachelor's degree in political science in November of 2020. Since 2018, she has been working toward ending U.S. participation in the war in Yemen. At Code Pink, she works on youth outreach as a facilitator of the Peace Collective, Code Pink's youth cohort, that focuses on anti-imperialist education and divestment. And just a second. Danica, say something. I think I'm having trouble with my headphones. Go ahead.
Okay, hear me.
Okay, you're talking?
Yes.
Okay, one second. All right, so I'm going to go to another song. Danica, please stay on the line. I have to get a headset that works so that I can hear your side of the conversation. Hang on. Biggies.
There's no room in this world for ambiguity. There's no time for reading between the lines. People are dying right now as I sing this song. So listen closely, they don't have that long.
Okay, thanks to Dan Robles for loaning me his headset. I'm so sorry, listeners. We're going to get back to our interview now. I have Danica Katovich on the line with me. Danica, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Off to a great start here. So, you know, I wanted to ask you as a young person, what led you to become a member of Code Pink?
That's a hard question. I've always been sort of in tune to foreign policy, I think, ever since high school. I was in high school. I took AP U.S. history, and I feel like so many young people have this story, but their history teachers radicalized them. And I just remember seeing Code Pink doing so many cool things and disruptions and going to Congress and calling Henry Kissinger a war criminal. And I was like, these women rock. So, just kind of by luck and connections, I ended up at Code Pink, but it's been really amazing working with so many women that I've looked up to for years.
And it seems like you really got thrown into the deep end now that you're the you focus so much on anti-imperialist education and divestment and issues we're going to be talking about today. But maybe you could talk a little bit about your role at Code Pink.
Yeah, so I work on the Middle East campaigns. I work on Yemen and Saudi Arabia, doing the boycott campaigns. Right now we're working on getting Lewis Hamilton, the F1 driver, to boycott Saudi Arabia's first Grand Prix that they are going to host for F1. That's at the later part of this year. So kind of things like that. But the Peace Collective actually launched in January, so it's quite new. But it's Code Pink's youth cohort, because I've been involved in the peace movement, I'd say since, like, actually involved in, like, going to org meetings and that kind of thing since my freshman year of college. So since 2017, I'd say. And I think everyone involved in the peace movement can kind of tell there's sort of a generational gap. And I felt sort of disconnected from other people my age. And I wanted to find a way to bring more young people into the peace movement, because they do care about these issues. They care very deeply. They're very aware. They're very smart and in tune with everything that's happening. But a lot of them just need to be called in, and talked to about these issues and given a space to talk about the issues themselves and why they care about it and why and learn tools for how to fight against the war machine. So the Peace Collective launched in January. We have a handful of amazing, amazing young people. The age group ranges from, I think, about 17 to 29. So it's a pretty large group, a large age range. But a few of them have started divestment campaigns in their cities or states. We have a little book club where we talk about anti-imperialism. We wrote a manifesto that people can check out at codepink.org/manifesto. That was all youth written, and it's called A World Without Empire, kind of where we just imagine what a brighter future would look like and how we would get there.
I'm grateful for your vision. It is really time to hand off the baton, and I'm grateful for leaders like you, Donica. You know, one of the campaigns that you were first involved in, from my reading about you, is about Yemen and U.S. participation and support for Saudi Arabia. And I was wondering if you could tell our listeners about how that's evolved over the years that you've been involved, and how you see our involvement to stopping our country's participation in that slaughter, the starvation of Yemeni children. Please talk to us about Yemen.
So like I said, I got involved in 2018. And that was around the time the U.S. was still giving full support for the war. I think at that time we were still, by we, I mean the U.S., refueling Saudi jets midair so they could continue aerial bombardment mid-flight. Arms sales, of course, and logistical intelligence sharing, that kind of thing. We were giving full support to the Saudi coalition, which included the UAE, that was a large partner in the war on Yemen. So at that time in Congress, we were pushing a war powers resolution, which is Congress's way of reclaiming war-making powers. Because according to the Constitution, the president cannot declare war. The president is the commander-in-chief, right? But he has no war-making power. That belongs to Congress. But as everyone knows, we've been at war my entire life. I'm 21, so been at war my entire life, and none of them have been formally declared, really. So there were several pushes to get a war powers resolution. I was involved, I think three bills I was working on regarding the war powers resolution. But one finally passed. I think it was in the early part of 2019 or late 2018. I don't quite remember. And it was the first time it had ever passed. It was bipartisan. Trump had to use his second veto of his presidency on it, and we didn't have enough votes to override it. So, of course, the U.S. stayed involved in the war in Yemen, unfortunately. But with a lot of grassroots support and amazing Yemeni American leaders, Pretty soon after Biden was inaugurated, he made that announcement that he was going to stop U.S. offensive support for the war in Yemen. And there was a big celebration about that. You know, it did mean something. But again, the phrase stopping offensive support, it does leave a lot of room, and it is very vague, and we didn't know exactly what it meant. So then a few weeks later, the Pentagon came out with a statement saying that U.S. contractors were still giving spare parts to the Saudi Air Force. So that is military aid, that is involvement in my eyes. So the U.S. is still involved in the war in Yemen, and I don't think the Biden administration has done enough to pressure Saudi Arabia to stop blockading Yemen. And the blockade is the main factor in the starvation and suffering of the Yemeni people. The blockade must end. It is stopping gas and fuel from getting into Yemen, which impacts every single aspect of life in Yemen. So the grassroots is pressuring a few people in Congress to introduce another war powers resolution, namely Representative Ro Khanna from California and Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. They've been big supporters. They led the other war powers resolution that passed. So if any of you listening are living in Ro Khanna's district or have any family members who do, please give him a call, ask him to support a war powers resolution and introduce one so we can stop U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen. Mm-hmm.
So listeners, you're at KZFR Community Radio. You're hearing Donika Katovich, and she is a Code Pink youth, a leader, outreach leader, a facilitator of the Peace Collective at Code Pink. Donika, the reason I got in touch with you is because I read an important article that you wrote in Counterpunch on June 11th. It was about arms sales, and it's what we know about bombs being dropped in our name. And you start off the article talking about Lockheed Martin bombs that were dropped on a school bus full of Yemeni children, and it was just kind of blood-curdling. And then, you know, the article goes on from there. But can you give examples of where our tax dollars are killing civilians in other countries?
Yeah. The story I started out with, it happened on August 9th, 2018, so we're coming up on the anniversary next month of this incident. It was a laser-guided bomb made by Lockheed Martin, which is a U.S. Weapons manufacturer, that, you know, our tax dollars go into these sales and, like, the facilitation of these sales of weapons, and a lot of it goes to benefit private companies like Lockheed Martin. That bomb was sold to Saudi Arabia in 2018, and it was dropped on a school bus of children in Yemen who were on a field trip. It killed over 40 kids, and the bomb said made in the USA on it. People who are victims of U.S. militarism know where these weapons are coming from. And it is just deeply shameful. And that happens. That was just one incident. It happens all the time. When Israel is bombing Gaza, they are using U.S. manufactured weapons as well.
Yeah. It's terrible. And you know what your article does is it sort of walks us through how we can be involved in this, and I think that's really important. So can you tell us first, what are the steps to an arms deal?
Yeah, so basically what happens first is either two sort of types of arms sales. So either it's government to government. So, for example, Saudi Arabia and the U.S. government would negotiate an arms sale. That's a public arms sale. Or it is between a country and a private company. So the article that I wrote talks about the Boeing sale to Israel. That was a private sale, which has a greater lack of transparency. Those sales do. So that's why it took us so long to find out about it. The story broke pretty late into the game that that sale was going to go through. But basically, whatever sale it is, either of those two that I just described, Congress has either 15 or 30 days to introduce a resolution of joint disapproval, 15 days if they are a NATO country or Israel or Australia, a few others, and 30 days if it's any other country. So basically, if the U.S. is friends with this country, we have good relationships with them, Congress only has 15 days to introduce a joint resolution of disapproval that would block the export license for the sale. And if they miss that window, then people kind of get sort of bogged down or they lose hope. But Congress can always stop an arms sale until it reaches until it's delivered, till the weapons are actually delivered. So what happens next is for this recent arms sale to Israel, the $735 million in precision-guided weapons that Boeing sold to Israel in a private sale, the story broke, I think, a few days before the 15 days were up. So Congress had almost no time to block this sale or block the export license. So the State Department issued the export license. That's already done. So the joint resolutions of disapproval that were introduced are kind of useless at this point. But we can petition the president to revoke the export license. We can petition the State Department to revoke the export license. And at any point, we can pressure Congress to stop the sale completely. They can block the delivery of the sale. That would take legislation of its own. It wouldn't be called the joint resolution of disapproval. But I think as a country and as people who are concerned about this, what we really should be doing is changing the laws around arms sales. Because 15 days is not enough to do advocacy. Everyone's familiar with how Congress works. It's very slow. It's a very arduous process for introducing and passing legislation, especially when it has to be bipartisan. So 15 days is not nearly enough, and honestly, neither is 30. So how can we make this more so anti-democratic? Because people have virtually no say in where these weapons that have our country's name on it, where they go, who they hurt. And ideally, we would block every arms sale because I don't think the U.S. should be selling weapons to anybody. But we kind of have to reinvent the wheel. Like, we need more than 15 days to stop an arms sale. We need more time to educate people on what exactly is being sold and getting people to actually contact our Congress people and lobby them to vote for the blocking of the sale.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Code Pink is one of the few organizations that I ever get wind of any of this stuff from. You know, you just don't hear about it until it's a done deal. And in your article, you also say that Section 502B of the Foreign Assistance Act says that weapons sold by the United States cannot be used for human rights violations. So why are any of these even permissible? I don't understand.
That is a great question. So I should have said there are two laws that govern arms sales in the country. It's the Arms Export and Control Act, which that's where the 15 to 30 days come from. The Arms Export Control Act. And then the Foreign Assistance Act. So Section 502B says, like what you just said, it can't be used for humanitarian rights violations. So when Saudi Arabia dropped that Lockheed Martin-made bomb on that school bus, what was that if not a massive human rights violation? So when we look at the war in Yemen, the primary targets of these airstrikes are weddings, funerals, residential neighborhoods in Sana'a, the capital city of Yemen. So the United States has no legitimate justification for their use of U.S. manufactured weapons in Israel or in Yemen by Saudi Arabia. But there's so much, it would be so hard to prove and challenge that it doesn't count as legitimate self-defense. But technically, if we're objectively looking at what these weapons are used for, it is not legitimate self-defense. When Saudi Arabia has the most powerful, army and military, the United States standing behind them. There is absolutely no legitimate self-defense there.
So this weaponry that was going to Israel, that's the last one that you posted about. And what can we do to block the sale? Can you be very specific about what your ask would be for my listeners?
Yeah, of course. So like I said, the export license was already issued by the State Department. There's a few routes we can take. I think the one that I'm more optimistic about, that I think would be a real game changer, is if we all called our congresspeople and we said, we want this $735 million sale to be blocked. We don't want it to be delivered. You as my congressperson need to introduce a bill to block the delivery of the sale from Boeing. That's kind of our only route at this point, unless we can get Antony Blinken to revoke the export license. But asking Congress to introduce and pass a bill blocking the sale. And people might say, how are we going to get enough Republicans on our side to pass this? It's been nothing like that has ever happened before. So there's that. But there have been things that have happened over the last few years to make me optimistic. In 2019, there was a bipartisan joint resolution of disapproval to block an arms sale to the UAE. And Trump vetoed that as well. But it really showed that both sides of the aisle are really willing to work together to block an arms sale in a way that a lot of people wouldn't expect. But the support is there. It can be achieved. So that's something not to get our hopes up about. But I definitely recommend people calling their congresspeople and saying that they want legislation introduced to block the more recent arms sale to Israel.
So two questions really quick, because we're almost out of time. What is the weapon system called that we're asking? That's the Boeing arms. What is it? The actual weapon?
Yeah, so a lot of them, so precision guided weapons would be the more vague term, but they're called, a lot of them were JDAMs, which are I forgot what it stands for, but basically they're kits that turn dumb weapons or unguided weapons into precision-guided weapons. Mm-hmm. So they're all precision-guided weapons for a vaguer term.
Okay, last question. I got to participate or listen to a workshop that you facilitated the other day, and I would like your opinion about the Selective Service and women being... I'm going to use the word forced to register for Selective Service. And thank you for being with us today, Donica.
Oh, of course. Thank you. Yeah, abolish Selective Service. Adding women to the draft is not feminism. No one should have to sign up for compulsory military service. That's what we were calling for, is the complete abolishment of Selective Service.
Okay. And how can people find you on the web?
Yeah, so codepink.org. Also, my Twitter handle is Wife of Toast. But yeah, you can find me on Twitter, and I'm on Code Pink's website quite often. Codepink.org/Peace Collective is where our youth cohort, if you're a young listener and want to join, please sign up there. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, Donica Katovich. I really appreciate your work. Thank you so much for being with me today on Peace and Justice.
Thank you so much. Have a beautiful day.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, she's exciting. And someone's calling. I can't answer the phone right now. I apologize for that. This is the Peace and Justice Program. I wanted to make an announcement that there is an indoor cooling center happening each day until July 17th at Faith Lutheran Church, 667 East 1st Avenue, or East 1st Avenue and Mangrove, if that helps you remember. And that is from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. All are welcome, including your pets. So if you need a cooling center, there is some restriction on the number of people who can use it. So show up early, please, 2 o'clock at the cooling center, especially this weekend when it's supposed to be so horribly hot. All right, so I'm going to just play a Salmon song. Very distressing news about the water and the salmon right now. And so blessings to run for salmon people, you know, prayers with them and their struggle to keep the salmon run and on the salmon in the Sacramento watershed alive and healthy. So here you go.
There's no room in this world for ambiguity. There's no room.
Cry a song, shed a tear for the Northwest salmon, sockeye streak of muscle, brawn and steel-headed will, swimming salt water, fresh water, feast or famine, their battle is uphill. Cast an eye of wonder at a river fast and long. It is a highway, it is a maiden voyage, a swan song. Feel the force that against the rushing ripples flow as a fish on a survival death journey go. Salmon River winds its way through Idaho, and it sparkles as it runs, and it glistens as it flows. Many rapids bubbling down cry a last farewell, where the sockeye will go now, no tongue can tell.
Sorry to shut that off abruptly. This is the Peace and Justice Program on KZFR Community Radio. We are brought to you by you, the listeners, and thank you for your recent support for the Peace and Justice Program and for KZFR during our recent pledge drive. We really appreciate you. I do believe we made our goal on that Corporation for Public Broadcasting grant, so thank you. I'd like to also thank Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. Also like to thank Chico Velo, supporting bicycling education and advocacy since 1980. Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bike valet when available at the Thursday night market and the Saturday farmers market. For more information, visit chicovelo.org and find them on Facebook. So it's just about 12 noon straight up. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. I'd like to thank a couple more underwriters before we get on to our next guest. The Peace and Social Justice Program is made possible by the Regional and Continuing Education at Chico State, offering online graduate test preparation courses for those seeking an advanced degree in a wide range of fields, including law and business. Sign up for a complimentary strategy session to help you prepare to take the GRE, the GMAT, or the LSAT at rce.csuchico.edu. Also, Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves, but also drink with others. And if you enjoy the program, you can always go to kzfr.org and tip the show. We appreciate that very much. And I'd like to get our next guest on the line. I hope I just paused this song. So we're going to go, it'll blast again here probably in a second. But such a beautiful song, and it's by Cindy Callett. And anyway, it's a different river system, but it's the same struggle. Hang on. Here we go.
There is a sad song in the crystal water's flow. Where have my salmon gone? The river wants to know. In spring came salmon, gave the river its name, shimmering salmon. One day no more came. Say a prayer with the Indian, came here to offer thanks. For this bounty, this feast, filled the river bank to bank. For this life-giving dance of 10,000 years, cut short by the plans of a corps of engineers. Cry your many angry words at an arrogant race. Gotta grab all the land, all the water, all the space. Gotta take, gotta make, gotta get, gotta plunder. Gotta dam it up, gotta chop it up, gotta plow it all under. For the salmon is a journey, it is a first and a last journey, down the Salmon River to the Snake, to the Columbia River, to the cold dark Pacific, this teeming life delivers, if not swallowed in the web of a toxic grip, they'll be following that scent on an ever. If not taken in the drift net factory ships, through the krill-laden Arctic sea waters they'll slip. If not slaughtered for the worth of their bright orange robe, back to the waters of their birth, salmon doggedly go. Back to the dams the electric ratepayers build, to the cascade clear-cut river turned. Against a current of water, against a current of time, against a gotta get yours, gotta go get mine, against a plenty, plenty of blame to go around, against a river been so tamed that you cannot hear the sound of the salmon.
All right. So the blame that goes around, that's what we're going to head for now. I have on the line with me Vincent Dejanich, and he is a veteran with Veterans for Peace, and I learned about his project from a handout that we've been, using at Beale Air Force Base for a couple of months now. It's on our climate crisis and U.S. militarism. It points out, as we some of us know, that the U.S. military is the largest consumer of oil and emitter of carbon dioxide. So Vincent Dejanich is a native Californian. He grew up in Sacramento. He was in the Army from 1968 to 1970, spending the last part of 1968 and all of 69 and the first part of 1970 in Vietnam. He's a lifetime member of Veterans for Peace and has been active in the movement for change since 1970. In Vietnam, he was in the 101st Airborne in the infantry. Besides his Veterans for Peace work, he is part of the Climate Reality Project and a group called Sustaining All Life. He's a founder of the Climate Crisis and Militarism Project at Veterans for Peace. And I want to welcome you, Vincent, to the Peace and Justice Program. Hi.
Hi. Call me Vince. I like that better.
Yeah, that's how I am. I'm Christine, but I like Chris. So, you kind of had a really romantic idea about war when you went, and you were looking for adventure. I think a lot of young people are like that. How did you? You were also rather conservative in opposition to your dad. How did your perception change? How did you become such an activist? You're a feminist. You're an environmentalist. What shifted you when you were in Vietnam?
Well, that's a big answer. I think there were a couple of things. I think the first thing I'll say is the adventure wore off really quickly. You know, it doesn't. You know, you get in a firefight or you get shelled or something. People get wounded. People die. And then you realize, well, this is no joke. You know, this isn't a comedy show. This isn't a TV show. So I think that was the other part. And then the second thing was I grew up really poor. My parents were immigrants from Central Europe, non-English speaking. And I grew up really poor. I'm by U.S. standards. Okay. Let me make that clear. I went to Vietnam and I saw some really, really poor people. I mean, that were much poorer than we were in the U.S. But the other thing I think was that the Vietnamese, and I couldn't get it in my mind that these poor, dirt poor farmers, for the most part, mostly tenant farmers, or probably in U.S. terms, mostly sharecroppers, could be my enemy. And I did not understand that. And then I realized that these people in the Vietnamese, for they were just trying to survive. And I ultimately realized, well, they didn't really mostly own their own land. It was rich landlords in the cities that owned their land and had sway over their life. And I got connected that way. And then just the way that the U.S. military treated the Vietnamese, and, was really awful to me. It was very gut-wrenching and heartbreaking for me. And I found myself in a situation where there was really no place to go. I just had to suck it up and do my time, pretty much, until the end. And then there was some organizing against our involvement. Active duty people. I wasn't too involved in that, but it was fairly quickly that stuff happened, And the other thing that influenced me was, we would get care packages from various organizations, and they would send us books to read. And one of the books they sent was an autobiography of Malcolm X. which was a pretty radical book, but I read it, and I kind of made the connection between the way black people were treated in the U.S. and the way that we were treated in the Vietnamese. And I think in some ways, many ways, that my picture of black people was different than most white people, because I grew up in a mainly black and, at that time, Chicano neighborhood when I was young. And I had more of a sense of who those folks were as human beings, and not the stereotypes that were all fed. So I think all that really contributed a lot to me shifting my perspective.
Right. Okay. So I think we're going to need to skip forward like 50 years. This is really unfortunate. The thing about time, I wanted to cover, more about your anti-war work and your work against, on social change issues. But somehow you have become incredibly involved in climate. The committee you're in with Veterans for Peace is very high-powered, and you're doing this climate crisis and militarism project that you started last August. So what got you guys together, and how did you start?
Well, there had kind of been a climate group in Veterans for Peace for some years, but it had been mainly dormant. And I had realized that, that studying the science of climate change, not the political movement, that we were in a dire situation and there was a crisis. And I have a cohort, Steve Morris, who has been doing this with me, and him and I together decided we wanted to start a climate group. There was a workshop at the last convention, and then we passed, the one in 2020, we passed a resolution that we would look at climate and the militarism. And My personal goal, and one of my personal goals, is to get somebody in every chapter in Veterans for Peace doing climate work, you know, whether it's just on their own or with another climate organization. There's plenty of them. I don't care which one you want to choose to work with, but or to just to educate yourself. So it, we saw it, and we saw that the military had a huge contribution, played a huge role in it in many ways. In one way, the amount of oil we use, the military uses, and how much CO they emit. But on a larger scale, I mean, the military is all about keeping the oil flowing. We have 800 bases throughout the world, and they're basically dedicated to keeping the petroleum economy going,
yeah.
Keeping the resources flowing in that the quote economy needs. And so we basically saw all this and looked at it and looked at, I guess, the IPCC UN report about, you know, climate, about, so we need to make some big shifts in the next 10 years or we're going to have problems. You know, and there's some people that think that we're going to have problems anyway. And I think the way that science-wise, it's clear that things are going to get worse before they get better.
Yeah.
Because when you put carbon in the atmosphere and it winds up in the ocean and warms the ocean, it takes about 40 years for it to recycle and come out. So basically, the stuff that we're looking at now is what was done in 1981.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, one of the things that shocked me is I heard an interview with you that with Beyond War's David Swanson, and you said that there's, and I knew this, there's at least 800 U.S. military bases around the world, but their carbon footprint doesn't get accounted to the United States military. It goes to the host country. Is that so?
Well, I haven't verified that, but that's kind of what I got from a congressional aide. Somebody spilled the beans and they weren't supposed to. There is no accurate accounting of how much the military, how much oil they consume and how much CO they emit. And they're all just estimates because the Pentagon is not liable to any of those laws. They're exempt from any kind of any regulation that the Environmental Protection Agency has or any other climate organization or regulations that are in the U.S.
Mm.
So it's all estimates. But the amount of money that we spend, that is not an estimate. And the U.S. spends more than $732 billion, and it's larger than the next 10 countries put together. And a lot of that is on fuel. The fuel that's one flight of an airport C5A transport. That amount will run a car for 7 years. So it's like I said, it's all estimates, and that's what I've heard. We haven't been able to verify that with anybody else, but I'm sure that it's accurate. That any way the military can push something off on somebody else, they will.
Right. And another thing you brought up that I found somewhat surprising, but it rang true to me because I'm involved in a lot of environmental groups, is that they never address militarism. They never look at the largest polluter. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's kind of one of the reasons that we started this group. And one of our main missions, I guess, is to take, we've developed a slideshow about climate and militarism. And we're basically, our main goal is to take that to the environmental movement, to different organizations that we connect with. And I think it's very difficult to get people to look at military stuff. I think partly this country has a huge hangover from September 11th, 2001.
Hmm.
There's a huge hangover. There's been some movement to get the law changed, the authorized use of military force law changed that enabled the government and the Pentagon to go on. So there's huge fallout to that. And so I thought, we think that's why it's important that veterans who are war veterans, some of us combat veterans, you know, take the lead on addressing this and do the work in the environment. And we would like transparency. We would like an accurate accounting of the fossil fuels that the U.S. government uses, the military uses, and the amount of CO2 that they put in the atmosphere. Like one of those C5As, you can put three Abrams tanks in one of those, and that's a big plane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you want to get tanks to, I don't know, pick a place in the world, you fly that and you do air refueling. There's also, you know, another plane and more things. And I think and most of the fuel that's used by the oil that's used in the military is by the Air Force on these large planes and on other planes that they use, airplanes.
Yeah. This is Chris, and we're on KZFR Community Radio on the Peace and Justice program. My guest right now is Vince Dejanich. He's a veteran for peace, and we're talking about the Veterans for Peace Climate Crisis and Militarism Project. So, Vince, you went and met with Senator Kerry, who is himself a Vietnam veteran, somebody who back in the day stood up to lies, and I was wondering how that meeting was in April. How did that go, and what's happened since?
Well, actually, he's not a senator anymore. He's a climate envoy, which is, you know, is not like part, kind of related to the State Department, but he really doesn't, not part of that, because those kind of officials need to be approved by the Senate. We thought the meeting went well, but, you know, then they've just kind of, like, a lot of things were said, but they've kind of treated us like a hot potato since then. We've made numerous attempts to contact them again to talk about things that they were going to do with us, other people they were going to connect us to in the government, and basically none of it's happened. So it's really disappointing. But I know that our executive director, Garrett Rappenhagen, who has been in contact, has repeatedly sent emails to the people on Kerry's staff that we met with, which was the people, by the way, that told us that the emissions of the Air Force or the military in other countries was counted against that country's toll and not the U.S., which isn't really counted anyway and anywhere. It's all estimates.
Mm-hmm.
So it is pretty disappointing, but we're hopefully now we're meeting with some staff people of Congress people, and we're a little more hopeful that will play out well.
Yeah. So the Senate recently undermined any of Kerry's efforts to negotiate a joint U.S.-China statement addressing the climate crisis. They undermined Kerry when they passed the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act. Can you talk about that?
I don't know much specifically about the act, but it's just part of a general policy trend of, I would say, both parties of the United States to make China an enemy.
Yeah.
And what they're most afraid of is China's rise as an economic power. They don't want the Chinese to do well. They don't want the competition. In some ways, they've already got it. And I think what they're most afraid of is a thing called the Belt and Road Initiative, which I'm not going to just... people can look it up if they want to know what it is. I don't want to spend time on it.
Okay.
But it's, you know, it's definitely undermined Kerry, and I don't know. Nobody said anything in the government about that, and the Democratic Party, and I'm not sure what... I think Joe Biden's trying to play both ends against the middle,
right,
in some ways, with some of the ways that he does. And he's a practical politician with a lot of political experience and knows how to work the system really well. But I think that this whole thing about China needs to be exposed. I mean, it's basically analogous to the strategy that was employed by the United States in the 1930s to manipulate the Japanese and put them in a position where they had no other choice but to attack us at Pearl Harbor. I think they're trying something similar, but the Chinese are not going to bite on that attack, so they're doing something different. They're going at Hong Kong, at Taiwan, and then this initiative as well.
Yeah, it's very frightening. I've been noticing that, too, and there's something called the Eagle Act proposed by Representative Meeks, which would increase militarism in the Asian Pacific, quote-unquote, theater. Vince, I wanted to ask you, too, about this time where we're leading up. There's a four-month countdown now to COP26, and the climate envoy, John Kerry, is going to be leading the U.S. delegation in these U.S. UN-led climate talks. Mm-hmm. And we don't have any time left as human beings. I mean, I think you're in California, too, but we are, you know, we're losing access to water, and the heat is making it so pretty soon pollinators won't even be able to, you know, mm-hmm. we will lose access to food and water, and also not be able to cool our homes because the electricity grid is going to crash. So, I mean, there's a lot of dire stuff, but it is true. So what can we do in terms of laser focusing in on the United States and Kerry, and what should we be doing?
Well, I think that at this point, anything that you can do, any action that you want to take, any group that you want to work with is a good thing. I think, unfortunately, we're behind the eight ball by about 40 years, you know, and to speak of. I think getting people on board with climate change, getting people active, is a main thing. Strategically, I'm not sure, to be honest. I know that we're trying to develop relations with the environmental movement, and I think the environmental movement needs to expand beyond its limitations, which I think involves some looking at who we are and how we got there, and how we need to change to make our organizations, you know, more friendlier to people, you know, that are not white, for one thing, in the United States. And so I think it's a big task, and that's why I tell everybody, you know, any organization that you want to work with that's doing stuff, go work with them and push them to do more at this point.
Yeah. So the Sunrise Movement, 350.org, Extinction Rebellion, what others?
Extinction's Rebellion, Sierra Club even, and Citizens Climate Lobby are the main ones.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That people that can get involved with and try to do as much as you can. I think all this personal stuff you do about recycling and saving water, that's kind of a nice approach, but it's not enough. We need to change the policies, and it's very difficult because we're basically asking the whole human race to do a 180-degree turn.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Away from an economy that's oriented towards economic growth, and we're asking that nobody be left behind.
And these pipelines. You know, we've got to stop these pipelines.
Well, yes, definitely stop the pipelines. It's part of leave it in the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I'm going to give you the last word, but I do want to ask you to tell us how to get involved with your group, because I just signed up. There's a place on the veteransforpeace.org, Take Action Climate Crisis, that which you can just Google, folks, where you can sign up. So what happens when we sign up?
One of us will get an email and we'll contact you about when we're meeting. And then you can join in one of the things that we're trying to do. But I'm sure first we're going to ask you to join the organization, either as a veteran or as an associate member.
Yeah. Okay.
And And there's an email that you can contact as well, which is climate@veteransforpeace.org. And I or Steve will get those emails if you just, or you can, as you stated, go look at veteransforpeace.org and find your way to the climate crisis.
That's great. So do you want to say anything else to our listeners? I mean, we're just getting out of some of our wars for oil. We are looking for new wars, you know, in Africa and China. Nothing has changed with the U.S. military. The budget this year was larger than ever.
Yeah.
So
yes.
What would you like to say, Vince Dejanich, as you leave this audience?
I would encourage people to stay hopeful. Hope is a discipline, you know, like learning a language or playing guitar or something. You have to work at it. You have to make a decision that I'm going to continue to stay hopeful. Just it's a subjective thing, and yes, I don't know that we're going to turn this around on a dime because it's a huge thing to turn, but we need to keep working at it and talk to people, and better yet, listen to people. Learn how to listen to people. Those skills are important to move. We need to move more people.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, thank you so much for your work. And I won't say thank you for your service because I didn't believe in the war, the American war. But I do wish you peace, and I really am grateful for your more than half glass full statement there at the end. I really appreciate you, Vince. So please take care, okay?
Yes, thank you. I do have a response to thank you for your service, but we can do that another time. Oh, it's actually nice, but it's...
You want to say
I appreciate your sentiment... But if you really want to thank me for my service, get active in the movement against militarism and for climate justice.
Beautiful. Thank you.
That's what I say to people, that they thank me for my service.
Thank you. Thank you for that, too. All
You're
right.
welcome.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. So this is the Peace and Justice Program, and I appreciate everything I learned from these guests. It's such an honor to be with you. And I'd like to have one more guest with us today. I'm going to try not to mess this up again with the music, but kind of comes with the turf with me. This is another John Michelson. This is from his earlier work, Code Red, which he did after the start of the Iraq War. Here you go. Spirit moving us. And I hope you all staying cool out there. We have an important guest on now, someone who is going to help us understand what's happening in our community of Chico, California. I have on the line with me Marty Dunlap. She is a local public interest attorney. She's been providing a voice for those who need one for groundwater protection, advocating for trees, police reform, and most recently assisting with finding humane solutions for the local unhoused population. She's previously worked in higher education as a counselor and generating statistical data on student performance and satisfaction. She prefers to mediate disputes seeking common ground amongst the stakeholders. Marty, welcome to the Peace and Justice Program.
Thank you, Chris. I'm glad to be able to be with you today.
Yeah, I am glad. The timing is perfect. We were wondering what was happening with Judge England, and then he came with a preliminary injunction last night. We're going to get to that in a minute, but I just want to get a little information about you. For years, you advocated for groundwater, and in the last few years, it seemed like you were everywhere, involved with Chico Concerned Citizens for Justice, advocating for safe shelter for unhoused people. What moved you more into the social justice arena, Marty?
Well, actually, what really pushed me in that direction away from the environment, because I really was trying to give a voice to trees and water and things that don't typically have a way to communicate with human beings about their benefits for us. The thing that really pushed me in this direction was that a friend child had a mental health episode and was treated very roughly by our local police department. And I realized that people with mental health illnesses really need to be treated and encountered with people who have training rather than with force, because they don't really respond to the command and control, you know, do this or don't do that. They're having an episode. And so when there was the loss of life in Chico in 2017 at the hands of our local police department, I realized, this is happening in Chico, our sweet town that seems so benevolent, that we need to make sure that the community has a voice and is interfacing regularly with our local police department on behaviors that are helpful and ones that we think need to be moderated in such a way so that there is no loss of life and that there is a greater compassion for people who are having challenges. And then when the city council changed and they started to pass the laws to make it impossible for people to be unhoused and also be safe and able to be in place, I realized that I needed to once again change my direction towards trying to make sure that the housed weren't being treated as criminals by the more recent ordinances that the city of Chico had passed.
Right, and Judge England talks about that in the most recent ruling that he gave, and I want to focus our time on that ruling, which came down last night. It's called a preliminary injunction, and maybe you could, for listeners who aren't in this big endless loop that we seem to be in with the city of Chico and our unhoused population, can you just very, very succinctly give a background on this situation?
I can. Basically, it does come down to what is being referred to as a web of ordinances that makes it impossible for a person who doesn't have shelter to be in the city of Chico without breaking a law and becoming a criminal. And so legal services in Northern California communicated in December, after the most recent ordinances were passed, about this web of ordinances that made it really illegal to be any place and sleep unless, you know, they were in one of our defined shelters. And so so when that happened, then there were evictions that started to occur in January, and people were being basically rousted. They were being given 72-hour notices, but then they were being rousted and moved, and their belongings, if they didn't protect them and move them themselves, they were being pretty much collected up and put into a dumpster. They said that they were going to be holding them, but it didn't seem like that was actually occurring. So these evictions started first on Cypress in the lower park, and then at the Horseshoe Pit, and then the Triangle, and then throughout lower park. And so anyway, as these started to happen, people were, you know, moving around. Okay, can I be here? Can I be there? Comanche Creek has been in place since, well, actually for quite a while, but definitely since March of 2020 with COVID, when the unhoused were recommended to stay in place and not move around, both by the state of California as well as by the sitting city council, that particular encampment had been in place. But then when Wind Chime was evicted, and which is also really the Humboldt Park, in April 1st, then people moved to Tykert Ponds. And so those are the two primarily large encampments. But people started to be moving around because of the different evictions that were being enforced by the Chico Police Department per these new municipal codes that had been passed in December by the now seated city council. So what happened in terms of, if you want to get an idea about the legal ramifications, the last places, Comanche Creek was set to be evicted on April 11th, or maybe it was April 12th, Monday at 8 o'clock. They had been given their 72-hour notices, and Legal Services of Northern California had filed a temporary restraining order, also known as a TRO, to stop that. And basically what a temporary restraining order is it's an immediate stop. Don't go any further. There's going to be irreparable harm if this happens. And so you don't have a great burden of proof to provide information except that there's going to be harm. And so Judge England did issue the temporary restraining order, which went into effect and stopped the eviction at Comanche Creek and basically stopped any more evictions based on the city ordinances that had been passed in December. So a temporary restraining order typically is for a very short period of time, 2 weeks, and then the preliminary injunction is starting to be considered, because that's really the law that is trying to be enforced. So what happened is, you know, first there was 2 weeks before the first hearing, which was April 23rd, and at that time Judge England said, okay, city, plaintiffs, you need to sit down and figure something out. I'm going to give you 3 weeks. And then they came back and said, we need a month extension. Okay, here's another month extension. Okay, we need another two-week extension. Okay, here's another 2 weeks. So everything has been put on hold. Nothing is happening except for that the two parties are trying to work this out. So when the hearing finally occurred, last Friday, July 2nd, a week ago, it had actually been 11 weeks that this TRO was in place, which is a rather long time period. But basically what it was trying to do is give, the judge was trying to do is give the parties time to try to work something out, which really wasn't worked out in terms of to the satisfaction of both sides. And so then he went ahead and made his ruling on the preliminary injunction. And basically what a preliminary injunction is, it's preserving the status quo pending a resolution of a case on its merits. So basically now it's a more formal, okay, we're going on hold. Nothing's going to happen. You cannot enforce these ordinances. You cannot be evicting people. We're going to now look at this case, and each side comes forward with their arguments about, you know, what this is about or not about. And specifically, it's about the legality of these ordinances. That is really the issue, is whether or not these ordinances are legal.
So let me stop you there. I think our listeners might want to know what's going to happen to that place out, we call it the death camp, out by the airport. Will that still be an idea that the city might continue to try to put forward to the judge, or is that totally kiboshed after everything that the judge ruled on?
I would say that the city may still consider that to be viable. I mean, certainly the arguments that were being put forth by the city attorney, Vince Ewing, on July 2nd, he was still saying that we think this is a viable place. They can be there. There's a tent. We have water. We have porta potties. We have hand washing stations. So he is still purporting to the judge that that place is viable. And quite frankly, I don't want to get into this quite yet, but I have been in communication with the city attorney, with the city manager about putting porta potties into Tykert, and we've been asking for it for a while. And he was coming back, and his argument back to me in his response was, we've got this place out at the airport. We have all these amenities at the airport. So I would say that right now the city is standing by that as being a viable location for the unhoused to live at this time and allow them to evict people from the parkways, the greenways, and the open spaces.
So, Marty Dunlap, we're here on KZFR Community Radio. I'm really grateful to have you here. But the judge said that place, calling a plot of land a shelter, does not make it so. The definition does not pass the straight face test. Apparently, the judge was not very impressed with the city of Chico trying to turn that plot of land. He even went as far as to define shelter. He used like 3 or 4 different dictionary definitions to try to clarify what would qualify as a shelter. Can you talk more about that? Because it didn't seem that the judge was going to buy that.
Right. I think it's absolutely correct. I thought it was great that he went to the dictionary to look up what a shelter is, and he was very clear that the airport is not a shelter. There is no roof, nor walls, nor water or electricity, or real cover or protection. And so turning to the dictionary, I think, was great. It also, however, was discussed amongst both the plaintiff and the defendant that in Martin v. Boise, which, of course, is the ruling case in this particular situation, that the definition of a shelter within that is buildings and beds. So they're looking for buildings and beds. And, of course, the airport does not have buildings nor beds, and so it doesn't constitute a shelter under Martin v. Boise.
And, you know, it was so interesting to see that, you know, all of this is about the constitutional rights of the unhoused people, but the city of Chico never seems to consider that. They want to get back to their rules and their laws, and they never, ever address the fact that they are that the plaintiffs are human beings. And I don't know if other people notice that too, but to me that's always very glaring that we still don't have a recognition of the humanity of the people in question.
And I think that is why there seems to be this split within the city, is that there's those who see the unhoused as human beings with rights. They belong. They have a right to be able to be comfortable and to be able to sleep and be safe. And with the basic needs that all of us as human beings strive for. And so there does seem to be a short-sightedness there. If you don't mind, Chris, I'd like to just take a time, and it's going to be, I want to talk a little bit about what a preliminary injunction means in terms of how the judge chose to refer to it.
Yeah.
And it gets into the constitutional right. Mm-hmm. So basically, the lawsuit and these ordinances being question about their legality falls really under the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. And what the judge is using as a standard, what he chose to define preliminary injunction, is based on a case in 2008, which is Winter v. National Resources Defense Council. And the standard for what a when a preliminary injunction should be granted is when the plaintiff is likely to succeed on its merits. Two, there is likely to be a suffering of irreparable harm. Three, the balance of equities tip towards the plaintiff. And four, an injunction is in the public interest. And so, looking at those four standards, Judge England determined, yes, a preliminary injunction ought to be granted. What is specifically also cited in a decision in 2014, Oyster Company versus Jewel, by the Ninth Circuit, when a government is a party, which of course the city of Chico is considered a government, the balance of equities that tip in the favor of the plaintiff is now merged with the injunction is in the public interest. So both of those come together, and both of those are met when there's a government entity, which is, of course, the city of Chico. And furthermore, when there's a constitutional right being violated, and in this case, the Eighth Amendment, all citizens, not just the plaintiffs, but all citizens have a stake in upholding the Constitution. We all want to make sure that our Constitution is upheld, and in this regard, the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. And so all the citizens of Chico have a stake in making sure that the Eighth Amendment is not being violated with the ordinances that the city of Chico has passed.
So, Marty, I want to ask you, though, we have a bottleneck in the city council that is supposed to be a representational government, but it's a limited number of people, and they do not seem to represent, I don't even know if people who believe, you know, in constitutional rights are the majority of the people, but it is the law of the land, and I don't think our city council is getting either advising their attorney to do right by the constitutional rights of the plaintiffs, nor do they themselves, as I said before, believe that these are actual human beings who deserve, you know, there's such an ideological battle around this. How would you advise our listeners to be involved, to press for these constitutional rights of these people?
So I think that's a really important point, Chris, that you make. And that is, there seems to be this holding on to the belief by the city council that these ordinances are legal. And the city attorney is actually arguing to the judge that it's not that these ordinances are illegal, it's that the way they're being applied. So if we just get the police to say different things, then they're going to be legal. And so you're right, there's an attitude amongst the city council that even though Judge England has been very clear, both at the initial hearing and this last hearing, that these ordinances are illegal as written, there doesn't seem to be attention really being paid to that. It's like they still think they can get around it in some way. And so I would say that for the citizens to become very outspoken with the city council to say, listen to what the judge is saying. These are illegal. There's no way you can make them legal under Martin v. Boise. The law of the land is this is not going to work. And even if you say you've got, you know, the I mean, it's kind of funny what they're saying is that the police will say, oh, let me call and find out. Oh, there's a bed available. Oh, how many people do we have unhoused in Chico? Oh, okay, we've exceeded, we're still under that threshold, so now I can arrest you. And basically, the judge saying no. So I would say that what the citizens need to say, hey, we love our city, and we appreciate that you want to keep the greenways and the waterways clean and not necessarily, you know, gabbing a lot of trash. But on the other hand, you need to do the responsible thing. You have access to $2 million to help the unhoused be in a situation and a living environment that is conducive to healthy and sanitation. And the city needs to get serious about providing multiple types of shelters.
Yeah.
Pallet shelters, sanctioned campground, car parks, that these things need to be pursued on a multidimensional level. And the service providers who have offered to organize and run these types of operations ought to be allowed to do so. And the city ought not to be still trying to hold on to these ordinances that are clearly not going to be upheld by the court. And let the service providers take this $2 million and start to provide a situation, an environment that does allow for a more humane living situation, that sanitation can be provided, as well as other needs that all human beings strive for, to have comfort in the summer and the winter environment.
Yeah. And there is a footnote on page 6 that the judge seems to be speaking directly to the city, in that he, you know, he says this is complex, you know, about how this is, how Chico and other communities are going to deal with the needs of the unhoused. And I think lastly, I want to ask you, Marty Dunlap, about how... Now, you've given us the kind of the way to go forward, but what is the next step in terms of the legal part of this that most of us don't understand? What's going to happen now? The preliminary injunction allows people to stay put, but what will be the pressures on the city? Will there be fines?
Right.
Will there be, you know, mediators? How's this going to work?
So this is an interesting situation, and certainly I understand Judge England. I mean, this has happened, of course, throughout California, not only, and then throughout the entire country, where there is a large unhoused population. The inequities are being made wider between those who have homes and those who don't. So with the preliminary injunction, basically everything stays in limbo, which is not necessarily a good thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it keeps us in a limbo state. And so as this is going forward, I think the judge really wants to see a settlement agreement come forward and see the two parties come to an agreement about, okay, how do we go forward so that we can resolve this without having to go to court. To go to court means that each side is then going to have to bring forward their arguments and argue them before the judge to determine whether or not there should be a permanent injunction, and that those laws basically will be struck down as illegal. Right now, we're just in a limbo state. And so what is difficult, I think, is that, you know, people who are living in at Comanche Creek or at Tykert or in other places are just still in, you know, they're still barely getting by. They don't have porta-potties at Tykert. We do have porta-potties at Comanche. The public is paying for two of the porta-potties at Comanche. We are willing to pay for porta-potties at Tykert, but the city is not allowing that to happen. And so we're just staying in this limbo state where the advocates, of which there are a number within Chico, who are making sure that there's water, that there is ice, that there is food, that there's access to other types of services for these individuals who are living in adverse conditions, and the city is not. The city's not taking care of this. I mean, they're paying for two porta potties and trash at Comanche, but they're not really addressing everyone else. And so what I'm concerned about, and I think everybody should be concerned about, is when we go into the state of a preliminary injunction, which can take a while. It's not necessarily going to be resolved quickly. If we don't get a settlement agreement, then everything is just going to stay in the state where, is the city going to come forward? Are they going to release this $2 million? Are they going to start to provide a better standard of living for the unhoused? Or are we going to just stay in this limbo state where others are having to step forward with food and water and the type of care, especially in the climates, the heat conditions that we can reach in Chico, for people with mental health issues, other types of disabilities, and other conditions that make their life on the streets very challenging. So we really are in a limbo state now with the preliminary injunction, waiting first to see if anything comes out of the settlement agreements, and then secondarily, if it has to go to court because we can't reach a resolution, then it's going to take the time to go through the courts and the arguments, and everything just stays on hold within the different places where the unhoused are currently living. And, of course, in my concern is, you know, there are things that need to be addressed in terms of trash pickup and sanitation. The CDC has been very clear about their guidelines that need to be followed. The county realizes that these are important. And the city doesn't, they're kind of just in this holding state of, well, we're in this lawsuit, but they're not realizing we've got human beings here who are suffering.
Yeah, let me stop you, Marty. We are out of time. And I really appreciate everything you said. And I think people are, you know, they get all this now, and really, really appreciate you telling us all about it. Thank you so much for your time and your expertise. Thank you.
You're welcome. Can I say one thing?
Real quick. Yeah.
So the real quick thing is the cost of the preliminary injunction is going to be expensive for the city, and it's also going to be costly to the unhoused, and it's really important that the settlement agreement can be reached quickly.
Thank you. Thank you, Marty Dunlap. Appreciate you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks.
Sure. Okay, so this is the end of the Peace and Justice program. Stay tuned for Playing Dead. I'd like to thank our underwriters, which would be Knockout Collision Repair, Chico's high-tech auto body shop specializing in complete collision repair and restoration. And Knockout Collision offers while-you-wait estimates, and they even handle all the insurance paperwork. For an appointment or information, call Knockout Collision Repair at 899-9202 or visit knockoutcollisionrepair.com and ChicoCallCenter.com. Employing locally since 1999, Chico Call Center is rapidly expanding and is now hiring new employees for their Nord Avenue location. Chico Call Center works with over 200 newspapers nationwide, renewing customers' subscriptions. Compensation packages include hourly, commission, and nightly cash payouts. More information by visiting ChicoCallCenter.com. Stay tuned for the community calendar. I just want to let you know that CHAT's having a fundraiser on July 14th. Go to the website for more information. We're doing a water drive on Saturday when it's going to be 114 degrees. 9 to 11, drop off water at the Hands at 4th and Wall. Also can use ice chests, ice, cold drinks, towels, and hand misters for unhoused people. Here you go. Here's the community calendar. Please take care of yourselves.
Hey, listeners. It's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM community calendar with me, Megan Hammer. The Paradise Family Summer Fest is holding a Friday night family movie. The original Willy Wonka movie, as well as free popcorn, all start at 8:30. This event is free and will be held at the Paradise Alliance Church, located at 6491 Clark Road in Paradise, on Friday, July 9th. July 10th, volunteers are needed for a cleanup day that will be held at the Nelson Sports Complex in Oroville, located at 2290 6th Street. The district-wide event is open for all of Butte County and hopes to see volunteers of all ages to help complete the project that will make a positive and lasting impact on the community. Volunteer tasks include painting, trash pickup, brush clearing, and removal of invasive plants. This event is from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. noon. If you have an event you'd like on the community,